Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Wednesday. It's the 19th of May. And we're going to be speaking with Orrin M. Levin Waldman. He's a socioeconomic research scholar. And he's going to talk to us about his latest essay. It's entitled The Argument That Labor Shortages Are Due to Additional Unemployment Benefits is Overly Simplistic. And he explains it, and we're going to get in touch with him right now because he's already on the line. So good morning, Professor. Great to have you on today.
Good morning.
Well, people don't understand what the basis for which we evidently have a shortage of workers, and yet we've been hearing a line of why people are not returning to work or that they're getting paid too much money in unemployment insurance benefits. But it's much more complex, as you point out in your essay. Why, first of all, don't we explain it the way it really is? Why do we make it so simplistic? Are we trying to demonize those people that are unemployed and that cannot return to work for many reasons that we don't comprehend, except you wrote it up in this article, this essay?
Well, I think we've been demonizing workers for a long time. I mean, you know, the reason why globalization is a problem is because workers won't accept lower wages. So it's the same basic argument. If workers weren't so rigid, then, of course, we wouldn't have unemployment. Everybody would have a job. Workers obviously are getting paid more to stay at home, so the argument goes, therefore, it must be their fault. It has nothing to do with the fact that the wages were low to begin with, and it has nothing to do with the fact that the businesses haven't been able to open up at full capacity, or that schools are closed and people have nothing to do, no place to put their kids for in terms of child care. So, you know, these are issues that have to be addressed as well. And the other thing that seems to have come to light is that you have a lot of people, particularly older workers, who are afraid to go back to work. And in some cases, they're so close to retirement that they simply decide to say, I'm going to take an early retirement. And that's partly why you're having this shortage. So a lot of these workers who are refusing to go back, it has nothing to do with the extended benefits. It has something to do with other things that are going on. Now, the extended benefits, or the enhancements, I should say, may be a factor, but it's not the determining factor here.
Mm-hmm. But I guess we don't spend enough time recognizing the rationale for the conduct of people who don't return to work, and therefore, because of a lack of enough workers, we seem to blame these people who may even be on the lower socioeconomic rung. Why don't we explain that? Like one of the most salient points you bring out is without the schools opening, there was no place to send the kids to school, so you had to teach them at home, and you needed to be there to protect them. God forbid the kids could get into trouble, not because they want to create havoc or anything, but they may not be paying attention to the broadcast of the educational program that's done through the computers. Sometimes they don't even have a computer system, so they have no education whatsoever, and they can get into trouble just because they have nothing else better to do, and they have nowhere to go. Why is it so difficult for us to just tell it the way it is? Who are we protecting here, or who are we demonizing here?
Well, you're demonizing the worker who's always been demonized, and you create the same war of the elites or the money class against the workers, the workers who are defenseless to protect themselves. And it's, you know, the reality is for a lot of low-wage workers, they don't have the equipment for their kids to learn adequately, even with remote learning. So, you know, is to pay them additional money so they can now have a little something extra to go out and purchase some of this equipment is not really unreasonable given the new demands we've placed on them due to the pandemic, or I should say the response that we've had to the pandemic. So it's a more complicated picture than simply saying workers have reservation wages. Reservation wages are created by unemployment insurance. The more unemployment insurance you have, the more likely workers are to cling to their reservation wage. That may be true. Your reservation wage is not determined by unemployment insurance. Your reservation wage is determined by your last good wage. People don't. The reservation wage is a wage beneath which you will not accept another job. So this is not a new idea. It's been out there for a long time. It was basically advanced by Martin Feldstein and as one of the co-authors, name I can't remember, but. See, this was in the mid to late 1970s, and basically they were arguing that we should basically eliminate unemployment insurance, period, because it basically raises workers' reservation wages. Now, if you are at death, say like New York, you're only getting 50% of your previous wages if you're a blue-collar worker. If you are a white-collar worker or a professional, you lost your jobs, you're most likely only getting a replacement wage of 25%. So it's hard to believe that unemployment insurance is going to keep you from looking for a job when you're losing that much in income.
Absolutely. And why do we forget this crisis, this pandemic, has lasted, as you point out in your essay, for it's over a year, isn't it? Or close to it. Around that figure, I didn't even calculate.
It's now May. It's since the middle of March. It's a year and 2 months, and we're not out of this yet. We're not finished with it.
We're not. And so, why do we forget that there is no way for many people? They didn't have a job to go to. So, and their loss of a job had a lot to do with the fact that the government didn't tell us it was going to last over a year. So everything has been shut down, as you say. Instead of opening up at 100%, we're opening at 20 or 25 or 30. And who knows how long it'll take before it really moves up the food chain. And we may end up needing to go back to 20% if we get another wave, because that's uncertain as well. What is it, the America's only up to 40% inoculated or close to it? Is there a lot of
not even, not
still
even 40%, 35%. That was the last a few days ago. So
it's insane. Why are we so simplistically willing to accept this harangue that we hear over and over? Or is it simply because we don't have people like you telling us the way it really is? And if we just look at it, we realize that those are the facts. We may just not have the mental capacity, and I include myself in that, to sometimes recognize that you evidently do you're very sensitive to this. What's wrong with
that? It's a nice narrative that the unemployed, people are unemployed because they're getting enhanced benefits. Okay, it sounds good.
Yeah.
It makes people not looking deeper into the problem. But again, the reality is it's a much more complicated issue, and you know this is certainly in line with an ideological position that you will see clearly in the pages of the Wall Street Journal. And also Fox News. So if those are your news outlets, then you come to believe that this is a reality. This seems to be a reality which is being pushed by many in the Republican Party who are more pro-business than they are pro-worker. Mm-hmm. But to believe, first of all, the unemployment insurance is only temporary anyway. So it's going to run out.
Correct.
So you're not going to keep it forever. At some point, even if it is true that it's prolonging people's unemployment. They're hesitant to go back to work. At some point, they're going to have to go back to work. The question is whether there will be a demand for their labor. And that's really the unknown here. We don't really know how many people are going to be brave enough to go into a restaurant and operate 100% capacity where they don't have to social distance, they don't have to wear a mask. We all know that. Sounds nice that just because the CDC comes out and says something, it doesn't mean that everybody psychologically is ready for what the CDC has now announced.
Well, that's confusing everybody beyond belief. They created that, the CDC created this, I guess, lack of capacity to understand which way we should go, and that's been the major headline for quite a few days. And so that's where that's going. What do we do about the fact that, for example, evictions are going to come about soon? I don't know exactly when, but the government hasn't invested time in creating jobs, or they got rid of jobs that could have employed people, because I don't know why they figured that was the best way to go. But instead of employing people, we're sending them checks. And $1,400 here and $1,400 again and maybe $1,400 a third time is not enough, because, like, if you look in New York City, rent has got to be way over $1,400 a month, or certainly $1,000 a month. And that doesn't stretch very far. It doesn't even pay for food. You know, every church, every synagogue, every mosque, and every other outlet is handing out free food. And you get one event after another in every community across the nation handing out food. People can't afford to buy food. So how are we supposed to get out of this mess? Or are we creating this mess and hurting ourselves in the process? Who's behind that? Is that big business?
I think people on the left want these grants. They think that people will need these grants. Maybe some people do. I don't know. The problem is, it's easier to write a check out to people below a certain income threshold, even if they haven't really lost their income, than it is to actually determine who actually needs the money. That's a more complicated mm-hmm. process, and nobody really wants to do that. So you want to get money into people's hands as quickly as possible. The problem is you're not really targeting well here. So you're giving $1,400 checks to people who haven't lost any income, and you know they're not going to spend the money in the economy. They're just going to bank it. So you're really not helping anybody here. The better policy would have been to compensate workers at 100% of their loss, as well as small businesses 100% of their loss, sort of under the Fifth Amendment Takings Clause, than to write these stimulus checks. We've discussed this before, but this, the government really does not target well. If you listen to people on the right, they will basically say, well, the reason why you want these stimulus checks is you want people to be dependent on the government so they can control you. I don't know if that's completely true, but I think that there's an element of, you know, the left believes that throwing money at problems is the quickest way to go, and the best way to pay for it is to simply tax the wealthy. Tax them too much.
And are we buying allegiance, let's say, from the potential voters who may not have voted before, because we're happy that they gave the poor or the ones in need money?
And that's the standard
when you have
public
no money,
choice theory.
$1,400 has got to be a fortune.
That's the standard public choice theory. If you give people free money, then they'll be loyal to you and they will vote for your party.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whether it's true or not is not entirely clear.
It may not be their purpose, or it may be their purpose, but at the end of the day, when you have no one else to assist you, then the government looks great and you would probably support them if they gave you $1,400, not once, but twice, maybe even three times. So it's just a reality, I guess, of where it's at. I was looking into PPEs, and I didn't know what they were, to be honest with you. I was looking into a political rationale of where the money, the government money was going, and I was shocked to see major, major firms with millions of dollars in revenue who claimed that their employees were no longer able to work, so they were laid off, so to speak, and they subscribed to the government for assistance. They got approval for the PPE funding program, and they're better off in the millions. And I've even heard that many companies don't even have as many employees as they claim they put on their applications, and the government has no means to figure out who's who, or even if they exist, but they're just handing out checks. What's going on there?
Again, it's easier to simply hand out checks than to figure out who needs them. It's also easier to offer enhanced insurance payments without figuring out what people's incomes were before they lost their jobs. So you can actually modify the payment for each person is different according to each person's income. So you're not giving incentive to stay home. And truthfully, we need an overhaul of the employment insurance system anyway. The unemployment insurance compensation is too low in the United States. Uh-huh. Other countries reimburse at 75-80% of their wages. We do much lower. There are some states that are better than other states. I mean, Massachusetts is a little more generous than New York. New York is really backwards when it comes to unemployment compensation. And other states even more backwards. So, you know, it's a problem. So in a sense, you know, on one level, you could say the enhanced payments, particularly in states where you have very low replacement payments, is an attempt to equalize across states the rate of unemployment compensation. But it doesn't, you know, how they came up to 600 originally is not entirely clear. 300 is probably more in line with trying to get people back to work if you really believe that this is creating a powerful disincentive. Again, at the lower end of the distribution, it may create some disincentive. Certainly not creating a disincentive at the middle and the upper end of the distribution, but the lower end. And so it's when people are talking about how we're incentivizing people not to work, it's hard not to believe that this isn't simply another attack by business owners against the most vulnerable of workers, those at the bottom end of the distribution.
I'm wondering, where do we go from here? Why is it when Biden came into office, we expected investment in infrastructure. We have roads that are breaking. We have bridges that are breaking. I don't remember where the bridge is, but one bridge, the girders had split. So I don't think it's safe to go over it anymore. I don't know if there's any traffic over it, but it needs to be fixed, and it's going to cost a lot of money. Why don't we give jobs rather than checks? What's the purpose of that? Why don't we have a program that can get people to do work that may not be exactly what they used to do before, but only if they want to? It's not like you're forcing somebody to get a job that they may not be used to do it, but why aren't we training people to do that? And I think you pointed out, why do we get rid of technology that may be out of date, may not be ecologically sound, but until we get the ecologically sound operative mode of replacing those things, Why are we shutting down oil pipelines? Why aren't we investing more money in infrastructure to make sure that it's safe? We came to our knees only last week when we couldn't get oil. A third of the nation didn't have oil. I mean, that's insanity. Who can go to work if you can't get to work?
Well, you know, again, it's the same problem, but then there's a logical issue, too. There's this idea you want to create government jobs. We're opposed to that because they shouldn't be competing against the private sector. But there is an argument to be made that instead of providing public assistance payments, you could give them a job. You give them a hand up as opposed to a handout.
Right.
There's an argument to be made for that, and certainly ample precedent for it. We're simply following the playbook. And, you know, I think as long as, you know, the Biden administration is in the hip pocket of the left-wing of the Democratic Party, we're going to see more of these kinds of giveaways as opposed to constructing serious policy.
Well, it's all I know is, like, initially, if you even came to the United States without through legal means applying, getting a visa to come in, or a residence visa, whatever, then you couldn't go very far. But now I hear that there are many people who come into the country and they get a driver's license, and nobody seems to check if they can or cannot vote, and people are voting. So evidently, giving people funds and not even recognizing if they are or not citizens, because everyone now qualifies for getting funding from the government. They're definitely buying the vote, whether we want to see it or not. Where are the unions with regard to all of this, or are they just finished? Are they just of no value whatsoever, except some unions are strong enough to keep pushing whatever their agenda is and to maintain a good enough salary for their workers?
You know, this is an issue that has been out there for a while. Are the unions really representing the interests of the rank and file? Or are union leaders simply enamored by the fabulous salaries that they are getting as union leaders, which really have no relationship to the people, the rank and file members they're representing, who don't earn that kind of money? So they're clearly out of touch. Where were the unions when Biden canceled the Keystone Pipeline? These were people who gave him their support. And basically he canceled union jobs. And then here we are talking about, facing shortages because of the pipeline that was cut, but basically shut down due to hackers. But the shortage may not have been nearly as great had you not canceled the Keystone Pipeline. And so nobody really thought about these things. They just simply reflexively responded to ideological pressure and, you know, the reigning ideology of the day.
Is that really our ruin? Are we no longer able to measure, I guess, whatever we hear, whatever we read, and there's no balance in our conceptualization of what we're told? Are we so far removed from a reality that was only, what, a year ago, 2 years ago? And it's one thing not to remember or even to know the history of what happened 50 years ago or 100 years ago or 300 years ago, whatever the issue is, but we don't seem even to remember what happened 6 months ago. I mean, are we that ignorant as a society overall? Or who knows the real story, and how come so many of us don't? Are we getting a bad turn from the newspaper? Is media doing a lousy job? Radio, TV, everywhere you go? Where do you find the facts?
It appears the media has a narrative they want to push, whatever that narrative happens to be. I think the narrative of the day is capitalism is bad no matter what, and it basically hurts a lot of people. Now, certain kinds of capitalism are good. High-tech capitalism is great, but, you know, capitalism that, you know, allows billionaires to, you know, put their money in the Cayman Islands, that's not good. Capitalism that basically doesn't provide workers with decent wages and, you know, health care is also not so good. And the media basically feeds this. But the reality is that even when you talk about a welfare state, you're talking about public policies in tandem with capitalist markets. Nobody is really talking about eliminating capitalism in favor of socialism. And for all the talk about all these policies of socialists, they're not really socialists. You know, it's standard welfare states programs and policies, but that preserves the basic contours of a capitalist marketplace. And that's reality. And even if Bernie Sanders can dress it up all he wants, he's still at heart a capitalist, because that's the system we have.
Right. But his language, when I listen to him, his language is not as exact as it could be, and he doesn't validate a lot of his premises, so you just hear his dogma, or at least that's what I hear. I just hear dogma and a position. And that's what he takes, and he doesn't really bring forth both sides of the equation. But there isn't always both sides to an equation. Sometimes it's just there's a fact and there's just opinion. And there's a lot of opinion out of him, but no solutions. If you had a position, then we would know where you could go with it. Is that one of the problems? Have we somehow diminished ourselves by the manner by which we expect news to be reported, by our study of facts and of issues? Are we unclear ourselves? Do we come befuddled mentally when we look at an issue like this? You seem to be very clear to me, stuff that I never even thought of before, but you're certainly there. So I'm almost, maybe not quite shocked, but certainly, you know, you've got my attention with your essays because they say so much and they refute so much that we hear in the regular media. I don't read this stuff in the Wall Street Journal or the Economist or the Financial Times or stuff like that. Why is that? Is everybody on an agenda?
Well, the elites certainly have an agenda. They want to preserve the status quo as it is. And if you can basically throw some people a bone so they keep quiet, that's enough for them. You're not going to have a fundamental alteration of public policy. So I don't see any real change in how we go about addressing some of these problems, but I think, you know, the reality is it's a nice diversion to basically say our economic problems are no longer due to a pandemic, but they are due to workers who are getting too much governmental benefit.
And so it's their responsibility to get out of it, or we don't talk about the fact that we've created this milieu, this environment for them. Because we've been closed for 14 months, the kids can't go to school, and all these other things. Now we don't know who's coming to shop at the supermarket, because some will wear masks and others won't, and so many people will decide they don't want to wear it because they don't want to wear it, and that's evidently their right, but who knows? I know people are getting clobbered when they come into certain stores. They want you to wear a mask. If you don't, there's a scuffle at the door to keep people out or to allow people in. Are we creating havoc in our own country?
Well, you could make the case, look, the party that basically forced businesses to shut down has a responsibility to compensate workers, generally speaking. How they compensate is an open question, but they have a moral obligation to compensate people for their losses. As they see it, these stimulus checks are a form of compensation. So, you know, since we have forced the issue of closure on you, and the result is you've lost your job, in some cases you've maybe lost much of your business, we're going to give you something because we have an obligation to give you something. In many cases, it's not enough. In some cases, it's not properly targeted. It's probably too much. But that's sort of a moral obligation. If you believe, however, that everybody is personally responsible for their own circumstances, and you similarly believe the government should never have shut anything down, then government really has no responsibility to offer this kind of assistance.
So where do we go from here? Is this where we're going to sit now? And how long can we sit in this particular juncture and time before we need to do something else? Because we're still going to have people who won't have a job because the businesses or the place of employment is no longer able to go up to 100%. And even if we do go to 100%, it may only be for a little while before we get maybe a third or a fourth wave. We don't know why some people who were totally inoculated are, like it happened in one of the baseball teams. Eight people on a baseball team got reinfected somehow, even though they had the antibodies and they were clean before. What do we do with all of this? Do we have a plan or do we not yet know? So we're going to do exactly what we've been doing so far? And can we afford it? What about inflation?
There are a lot of people in the Biden administration who are concerned, at least privately, behind closed doors. They are concerned about inflation. And the government's spending too much. It's borrowing too much. It's probably printing too much. And there clearly are issues that will lead to inflationary pressure. It's probably the inflationary pressure to concern about is probably reflected in the volatility of the market at the moment. It's up one day, down next day, and not by small margins, but by fairly wide margins. And even the NASDAQ, which is your tech sector, is not doing so well. So there are concerns about inflation, but you know, there seems to be a blind eye towards it by key officials in the administration. They just don't want to be told that we're going to have inflation as a result of too much government spending. But you sort of have to pay attention when key figures from previous administrations, like Larry Summers, former Treasury Secretary and Harvard economist, basically say, look, we do have to worry about inflation, and they don't want to hear that.
Well, it's really very interesting that we're not paying attention to that whole issue. I caught up late last night. I caught up on some things that I needed to catch up to, just to see what was going on in the world. And just catching up with the news, I heard that Bitcoin had gone down a little bit because the Chinese were concerned that it was getting out of control. And then this morning, I see that something happened and some of Bitcoin and others, they dropped like 30% overnight or something to that effect. And that's really frightening. That could exacerbate or create a worldwide crisis financially in our financial markets. What do we do about that? Are we ready for that? Because I don't think there's a mechanism for that at the moment. It's going to drag everything down to the ground.
And it's a divide between economists within the profession. More institutional-minded economists will say, look, we have an economy which is so large, so vast, you know, a $8 trillion, $9 trillion economy can withstand this kind of deficit, and that should not be the priority. The priority should be spending to get people back to work, spending on investment, which creates opportunities, and we should worry about the deficit later. The more monetary-minded people, the old Friedmanites, basically take a different view, that too much spending results in inflation. Inflation is going to basically lead to an economic downturn, severe recession, if not ultimately depression. So it's, you know, different mindsets, but it's hard to believe that those worldviews are not in part driven by ideological presuppositions. If you're ideologically predisposed to the view that the best form of government is a small government and the private sector should be left to do what the private sector does, then you really you are going to take the view that any kind of deficit is simply bad because it means government is spending way too much.
If government spends too much in order to compensate for the crisis that we're going through now, then is it conceivable that the Chinese, for example, have so much of our money that could undermine us from undermine our resurgence while they are in the midst of a resurgence? Is that a problem that the Fed has to look into, or the government?
I think the government should be somewhat concerned that when you have deficits and the Chinese are holding your debt, that could potentially be a national security crisis. Nobody really thinks of it in those terms, but that's a reality, and that sort of forces one's hand in terms of, you know, trade policy and whether you investigate how deep you investigate with regards to origins of COVID-19 and, you know, other issues that are out there, how far, how much you press on human rights violations in China and Chinese satellite countries. So, I mean, I think those are issues that that should be front and center, but nobody really wants to address those, largely because Chinese do hold a large proportion of American debt.
Right. And so that's really an area we don't go to because it doesn't suit us to even consider it. Then are we doing anything, you know, below the radar to try to diminish the debt that they hold so that we're less vulnerable? Because, you know, what you pointed out is extremely astute. And I don't know why we don't pay attention to that Achilles heel. You know, financially we can be undermined by the Chinese because they hold our debt. And then with people losing money as well, wherever they invest their money, you know, it's what are we going to do at that point? Do we become a vassal of China? I don't remember using that word ever in my life.
Well, again, if you are willing to look the other way, that becomes a blind spot for American public policy. And it's a blind spot that has been crippled not just Democratic administrations, but Republican administrations too.
Absolutely.
This has been an issue going back to the late 1800s, where America and other European countries looked at China as a prime opportunity to make investments.
Yes.
It was seen as the great new frontier for capitalist marketplaces. Inconvenienced for a while by Chinese Communist Revolution. But once they decide to allow for free markets, this is great news for the United States and other European countries mm-hmm. that were free market economies, and that this was a great opportunity for investment. And we have been willing to look the other way when it comes to human rights violations and everything else. The fact that they may be engaging in espionage and stealing our technology, that's we look the other way. And then since we run up debt, and the only way that you can basically borrow to finance programs is by floating securities. I mean, the federal government doesn't go mm-hmm. into Chase Manhattan Bank and say, I want a loan of $3 billion. And you put securities, and people buy bonds. So that's what we're doing, and they're buying up those bonds. Now, I sometimes wonder what would happen if the Chinese government says, pay up now or else. Could there be an or else? I don't know if that could ever happen, but it maybe that's the stuff of interesting novels, but it's not out of the realm of possibility when you think about it.
Yeah, has anyone said, I want to get paid now or else in history that you're aware of? I've never heard of anything like that. I guess that would be at the top of the food chain.
We haven't had it specifically couched in those terms, but I think it's fair to say that any number of wars have begun over attempts by countries to engage to embargo others. So in other words, the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor was basically initiated by the U.S. oil embargo on Japan. Japan felt that they had only had 1,800 months left in their supply, and they figured they did not think the United States would go to war. They simply figured if they attacked the United States at Pearl Harbor, then the United States would get the message and end the embargo and start shipping oil to Japan. They underestimated the United States' resolve. They figured we were an isolationist nation, we weren't going to get involved. But it was necessary to send us a message that this oil embargo has to end. That was, in some ways, that's sort of, end this embargo or else. And the or else was war, and basically we responded in kind. Now, we bend over backwards to avoid wars, and a lot of countries know this, that they push the envelope as much as they can push the envelope.
Yeah, that seems to be the case. Is that a new direction that we're going in, or is that really an evolution of our conduct as a nation from the very beginning? Or are we becoming less aware of what we're doing, at least from the public perspective? They're not always aware of what's being done, because policy is not always explained as well as one would think. So where are we heading, or are we in uncharted territory at the moment?
Well, again, I think we are in uncharted territory, but I don't know that we've ever been this much in debt before, and we don't seem to accept the limits that the debt imposes upon us. We simply respond, well, we can just borrow more. We can tax more. We can spend more. Let somebody else pay for it. Let the next generation pay for it. Let the very wealthy pay for it. Now, again, if you tax corporations too much, they will disinvest. So you'll have the opposite effect. You won't collect revenues. If do as a lot of people are suggesting, raise taxes on the wealthy, but let's bring back SALT deductions, so now the wealthy really won't be paying higher taxes, they'll be paying lower taxes as a result of a SALT deduction. This has been a problem. The wealthy know that if they say in theory they're willing to pay higher taxes, but they have enough deductions to offset those taxes, they have found ways to evade paying taxes. They will not be paying the tax. The middle class pays the tax. And the Laffer curve is rather clear. There's a point at which you reach diminishing returns, but when you raise your taxes too much, your revenue base goes down. So the key is figuring out what is the appropriate tax rate so you can maximize revenue without also maximizing tax evasion.
Got you. So we're not at that point yet. We haven't figured out where to go, but are we moving in the direction of taxing our very well-to-do? Is that the Bernie Sanders, harangue? Is that going to win the day? And will we understand, as people who are not so wealthy, that this is not going to work out too well? A lot of companies will just move their headquarters elsewhere.
That appears to be the rhetoric.
Wherever he wants in the world.
That appears to be the rhetoric of the day. But I don't. The reality is that you're not going to achieve that. And ultimately, the tax will fall on the middle class.
Yeah.
Or even the poor.
And the poor, too. So is that in a sense, does that define the different levels and different capacity of our people? We have very poor, we have middle class, we've got very wealthy, and in different grades, so it is what it is. But can we survive where our middle class and our poor are going to be paying the tariff, so to speak? Where do we go? This doesn't seem to be working. Where's the fault line? Is our economic system in question at this point? Or we're not nowhere near that? Should it be questioned? I don't know.
I don't think we're anywhere near that. I don't see the system collapsing, but its configuration may change over a period of time. The actors will certainly change. The industry has always changed. But you will still have people at the top of the distribution calling the shots. You have basically right now a new class of money barons, or robber barons, I should say. And they are your high-tech executives. These are the new robber barons. And they are basically in cahoots with government. Now, in the old days, the late 1800s, early 1900s, the robber barons were also in cahoots with government officials. There was a revolving door on Wall Street, and these executive offices of various oil companies and other railroad companies where people made millions of dollars, and basically they were had close relationships with government. Now we have a different set of actors who with a new revolving door, but the concept is very much the same. It rests on the same basic premise.
So nothing's really changed. So we're going to maintain this, structure. And there's no thought of changing it because it's not working for our middle class. And as you point out, if our middle class is not educated to the reality or unaware or can't control the mechanism where people say, well, you vote for us, we'll take care of you, and at the end we vote for them, and they don't take care of us at all. And there's always the rich to blame, but that doesn't go very far either. So are we the only society that you're aware of that is really engaged in this process, whether societies know it or not? Are they going through this in England or in France or in Germany? Are we the only one because we were always the power since World War II?
I think other societies are going through similar processes and are having similar issues, but some of the societies countries that you mentioned also have more developed welfare states. So, they already have made the decision that, the wealthy will shoulder a greater tax burden than the wealthy in the United States will. And we sort of fool ourselves into believing that the reason why we don't want to tax too much is we want to have investment. The more you tax, the less investment you have. It's a nice narrative and a nice rationale for not having a higher tax rate, but at the same time, the reality is there are ways to evade paying taxes in the United States. But there are more higher taxes in European countries. The marginal tax rate on income may not be much different, but you do have a value-added tax in European countries, which effectively raises your tax rate.
Right. Well, so is it conceivable, am I going too far? Do you think that we would start to emulate type of systems in Europe as far as the middle class is concerned, where they do retraining and to good paying jobs, as opposed to making you some police officer at a bank, you know, earning $7 an hour, which is not a living wage. Are we going to need to go there in order to compensate for our system the way it is now?
Well, and one argument that has been out there for a long time is that instead of talking about retraining programs, instead of talking about, free college tuition, you put the emphasis on community colleges. Community colleges is where people are going to retrain. Community colleges is where people will get associate degrees that enable them to take better jobs and, you know, say as technicians in healthcare and other things. And that's where the emphasis should be. If you want to give people the resources to retrain, then put the emphasis on using the community college system throughout the country for doing just that. We don't need new government programs for retraining. The problem with these government programs is that, you know, the question is, what are you retraining for? Most employers would probably want to have a voice in the retraining of employees for their specific businesses and the way they go about doing their business. And so you want to have specific training. You don't want a general retraining program, which leaves you sort of, you know, casting around for a job, but you don't have necessarily the skills that a specific employer is looking for. So, you know, you can address those issues by having a community college system, which we're trained for a whole variety of different things, and people just sort of specifically look at the industry they want to go into and retrain for that.
Well, you know, I wanted to ask you about one last thing. I'm sorry, somebody came into the room, which is not a problem. What I was wondering is, are we going to be able to move ahead, or are we looking at maybe another 10 years of troubled times as we acclimate to the new reality? Are we going through a transition and we don't necessarily know it, we don't feel it? Maybe the heat isn't hot enough, so we're not burning. But it seems like we're just smoldering a little bit as a nation with our economic structure, even our governmental structure.
Well, it's hard to know. I think, you know, we still have a cyclical economy in the sense that we have ups and downs. So during good times and wages are rising and people are doing well, nobody thinks of any in terms of any need for a transition to anything different. It's during the bad down times when people aren't doing so well, wages are low and there's very little job opportunity that people talk about need for transitions. So it may take some time to figure that out. I guess the question is how committed people are to a green energy economy, whether those transitions that requires will also lead to a lot of displacement, which we haven't really considered.
Why aren't we looking at that? I'm not annoyed about it, not upset about it, but I just wonder why we don't. It's not like you're looking into the future and you're becoming a futurist and deciding where things go, but then isn't that what big business does? They reflect and see where we're going and why we're going in that direction but the transition is not explained to the public so that we don't even understand it. And yet it gets voted through in government, so we have these big energy-producing windmills off of Cape Cod, and it took years to get approval, and now it's going to be moving forward. And are we going to be able to replicate that all over the place? And will that change the dynamic? I know everybody's changing their cars, their propulsion, you know, so now it's going to be electrical propulsion. You have to plug it in. We don't have any place to plug it in. I don't know where people are plugging in their cars. You have to have a private home in order to plug it in. So a lot of people are not going to be able to plug it anywhere. Like, I live in an apartment. There's no place for me to plug it in. And none of these places are, you know, near my home where there's a place to plug in your car and a couple of hours later, you're ready to go. Who's thinking about this? Are you the anomaly?
I'm sure there's some people thinking about it, but I'm not familiar with it. But, you know, I'm sure some people are out there.
I'm sure there are, too. Well, as usual, Professor, just brilliant. You're taking the time to speak to us and to our audience. Thank you very much. I always seem to learn something new every time I speak to you, and I thank you for that as well. Keeps me young mentally. I don't know about anything else, but at least mentally. So far, so good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Be well. Bye. Well, there we have it, folks. Orrin M. Levin Waldman, socioeconomic research scholar. We're going to, in a few minutes, we're going to be moving on. But before we do, let me just quickly tell you a little bit more about the professor and mention some of the work that he's done. Bear with me a second here. Where did I put this? I need to go to another page. Okay. Oh, I didn't realize that I actually ended up talking to the professor longer than I thought. I guess I got thrown off because people came into the hospital room, and evidently, I didn't know what they wanted or what they needed, so I was able to do it with hand signals, so that was good. All right, so let's move on to some other issues. I think that the mayor from Mount Vernon, Sean Patterson Howard, will likely give us a call today at 11:30. It's her scheduled time, but I wasn't able to check with her late last night when I put up the article that spoke about her attending the show. She's scheduled for today, so we'll be able to move on till about 11:30, and then hopefully she'll be calling us, and then we'll ask her about a lot of other issues that relate specifically to Mount Vernon. And then we'll be able to go from there and see what we're doing and what we'll be covering. So bear with me a second here. I want to move on to another page. One second. I have so many pages open, and I want to be able to give you the hyperlocal news first. Bear with me a second. Okay, this should work. All right, we're almost there. Okay. One second. All right, let's just quickly look at one of the most important issues of the day. It's not a very long article. I wrote this up very, very late last night. Actually, it was 12:25 in the morning is when I posted it. But I started writing it at about 11 o'clock. A lot of new information had come in, and this is what it is. It's a write-up by me, and it's called Yonker City Council Members Formally Beseech Inspector General Liam McLaughlin, Esquire, to make inquiry over two issues regarding Council President Mike Tater Esquire's conduct. It's written by me. So this is the article. The Yonkers Tribune has learned that six council members out of a total of seven requested that Inspector General Liam McLaughlin open a formal inquiry in conduct of Yonkers City Council President Mike Tater Esquire. In the letter to which all city council members ascribed their names but for Council President Tater, the six undersigned advised Inspector General McLaughlin that two issues of concern had become known to them and the public. Their first concern was whether Council President Mike Tater's relationship with his legal counsel, Jeff Buss Esquire, and Mr. Buss's firm, Smith Buss and Jacobs LLP, conformed to the ethics code of the City of Yonkers as well as all applicable city and state laws. Their second concern was with respect to an ex-employee's comment to Mr. Tater over whether a hostile environment existed and or continues to exist in the office of the City Council President. Now, the signatories to this letter advised Inspector General McLaughlin that under subsection C7-2 in parentheses A, of the city charter, entitled, quote, powers and duties, end quote, they urged Inspector General McLaughlin to engage in a thorough and transparent inquiry which addresses both real and perceived conflicts. The letter was undersigned by the following: Majority Leader Corazon Pineda Isaac, District 2, Minority Leader Mike Breen, District 5, Council Member Shanae Williams, District 1, Council Member Tasha Diaz, District 3, Council Member John Rubo, District 4, Council Member Anthony J. Moranti, District 6. One issue that they didn't bring up that was evidently recognized, which I had not, was written in an editorial in response to the initial telling of these issues to the public domain was written by Ron Matten. He also is running for City Council President, and he wrote an article entitled Ron Matten Calls on the Yonkers City Council to Investigate Quid Pro Quo Allegation in Council President Tater's Affairs. And so that was in response to a letter that we wrote. But one thing that was interesting was, one second here, where is it? One second. Okay, one moment here. Mr. Matten called onto the Yonkers City Council to utilize Article 6, Section C-12 of the City of Yonkers Charter to conduct a formal hearing and investigation into the quid pro quo allegation. The council president should step down, he writes, and recuse himself from further legislative activities until the council has completed their investigation. And then Mr. Matten also continues to say, quid pro quo is a breach of the public trust. This alleged violation harms the council and the city of Yonkers as a whole. As residents and taxpayers, we require transparency and assurance that our government is acting in our interests. And he continues, I suspect that council president would welcome this investigation to clear his name and restore the trust in the council and city of Yonkers. All individuals mentioned herein are assumed innocent. And Ron Matten was raised and currently resides in the city of Yonkers. And there was one other point that he made. Yes, this is the part I was looking for. And Mr. Matten writes, another material fact not specified in the article, which was mine initial that telling, concerns campaign donations. Smith, Buss & Jacobs LLP and their various partners have donated thousands of dollars to the Keter campaign. Use of the office for campaign activities is a, quote, like in kind, end quote, campaign contribution. This is one issue that I had left out in my initial telling, which Mr. Matten was astute to recognize. I had not. And when he wrote his article on the 15th of May, it had followed my initial article, which was dated, I think it was on the 10th of May. No, forgive me, on the 12th of May. And, okay, so that seems to be the case there. And so evidently there's also a question about that, which is interesting. Oh, no, forgive me. And then there was something else. It was on the 9th of May that we wrote our story about Mike Keter, an insider's perspective revealed by Karen. That's his conduct at his office. Then that was supported, that telling was supported by Collins Bellamy. And she, too, is running for the city council president position. So she's challenging Mike Keter for that position. Then we heard from us on the 12th with regarding to the quid pro quo issue that Mike Keter was revealed of Mike Keter and council the city council president, council Jeff Buss, with regard to quid pro quo. Then we heard from Ron Matten calling for the council to investigate. And so that's everybody in the mix. And then, of course, this latest telling, which is very, very compelling. Okay, let's move on to some other issues. Bear with me a moment. On the national stage, it seems that the Supreme Court is going to weigh in on the Mississippi abortion ban, which is recognized to be intended to challenge Roe versus Wade. It's an article on the Yonkers Tribune by Amy Howe. It was written and posted today at 12:31 in the morning, and seems that the Supreme Court on this past Monday set the stage for a major ruling next year on abortion, one that could upend the Supreme Court's landmark decision in Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, in which the court ruled that the Constitution protects the right to have an abortion before a fetus becomes viable. Well, the court granted review in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, a challenge to the constitutionality of a Mississippi law that, with limited exceptions, bars abortions after the 15th week of pregnancy. So we're going to find out where that goes. Again, you'll find this on the Yonkers Tribune website. Many articles that were posted right after midnight this morning. Then I think you'll find this interesting as well. While it's not a domestic issue, it's an international issue. We're in the throes of what seems to be inches away from an outright war in the Middle East. But before we go there, we need to point out that Yonkers Democratic City Committee has endorsed Jose Alvarado for re-election. Yonkers Democratic City Chair and City of Yonkers DPW Commissioner Thomas Meyer made that statement to Jose Alvarado for county legislator to the 17th District again. So that's huge, huge backing. Then you might be interested in reading about Westchester County District Attorney Miriam E. Rocha and County Executive George Latimer announcing that the county funding to local police for an interpreter service is in place. Bear with me a moment here. I see that I made a spelling error. So bear with me a moment as I make a correction in the title. Bear with me a second. And one moment. Or interpreter service, but it should have been for interpreter services. So it's good that I pointed that out to you. And this way I'm able to make the correction here as well. So bear with me a moment. I have to update this, make sure that it takes. To be honest, I thought I saw this issue yesterday, or rather early this morning after midnight, but evidently it didn't take. Let me look at it again in the hope that it did. Yep, thank God it did. Very, very good. Let me quickly keep up. We have so many people on the website. Okay. All right. Yeah, that was one of the questions. The question was, would Liam McLaughlin do an exemplary job as Inspector General with respect to finding out if Mr. Cater, the Yonkers City Council president, who's also a lawyer, conducted his business in a forthright manner that cannot be defined as quid pro quo, as we had initially stipulated. And so the request beseeching Inspector General McLaughlin was pertinent for someone in government to look over these concerns. He's a lawyer. He's capable of that. He is the Inspector General, and he knows the conduct of the city council. He used to be, at one time, the Yonkers City Council president. And the point is, and he's a lawyer, so he's going to look into it. But I expect him, and I wouldn't expect less of him, to keep it all on legal footing rather than to politicize this issue. So, and yet the comment that was just, I just put, approved, is that yes, Cater did vote for IG McLaughlin to gain his position. It needed to gain approval from the city council, and city council president Mike Cater did approve the appointment of McLaughlin to the position of Inspector General. And this took place when a position was opened for a Yonkers City Court judge. And prior to Mr. McLaughlin, the judge was, wait one second, I'm losing my mind with so many things, was, 1 minute, I'm losing my mind. Who was, let me just quickly think, Brendan McGrath. So Brendan McGrath was at one time, he was one time the Inspector General when a position was opened on the Yonkers City Court. The mayor approved him and appointed him to the Yonkers City Court. Then there was an opening from the position for Inspector General, and at that point, Mayor Spano appointed Liam McLaughlin. for the position, and Brendan McGrath ran for city for the position of the city court. He lost that position, and then the mayor's office appointed Brendan McGrath to the position of municipal housing authority as well as a lawyer. So that's how it was, like a musical chairs sort of thing, and you needed to know all the players in order to be able to recognize who was who and where they landed. So that was the issue game. So I do expect, of course, that Liam McLaughlin, he's an extremely astute lawyer. I remember listening to him in a case. He also knows political law extremely well. And I remember watching him in court in a case where he was defending a candidate at one time running for the city council position to the first district. He represented the candidate at that time. This was a few years back, and the point, the salient point that was brought up by Liam McLaughlin to the judge was one that was totally unfamiliar to the judge, who I don't recollect his name so at all right now, but a brilliant, brilliant jurist, and so I was surprised that he was not aware of it. And Liam McLaughlin presented the issues to the judge, and he said, if you're not familiar with it, Liam said to the judge, then, you know, he would understand. I guess he said that as a preface, not to diminish the judge, but rather to point out that it must have been very recent legislation, which may not have been familiar to many. So, and it turned out that Liam McLaughlin was on target, and the case was won by Liam McLaughlin, the person Liam McLaughlin represented, Dennis Robertson, that's his name, who wanted to run for the first district. Eventually, Dennis Robertson won the issue, but he didn't campaign whatsoever. I guess he must have thought that he would be able to win on just people being aware of him. Turned out he lost abysmally, and we now have Tasha Diaz, who represents the first district. So it is what it is. Fascinating tale. But Liam McLaughlin's a brilliant, brilliant lawyer. I had gained tremendous respect for his legal acumen at that particular time. Bear with me a moment.
Come on in. Hi.
On the radio. Oh, thank you so much. So, anyway, that's the story there. And so let's see what else. We're at about 18 minutes after the hour. So let's just quickly look and see a couple of other issues. I'm not exactly sure if, but I hope that Sean Patterson Howard, the mayor from Mount Vernon, will give us a call. And because there are quite a few issues that are of great pertinence and will impact the conduct of the of government in Mount Vernon. So bear with me a moment here as I look that up. One of the issues, so I'll give you a little bit of clue in, because the mayor, or should she come on, will know full well what this is all about. There's a candidate by the name of Derrickson Lawrence who's suing to stop the Mount Vernon, the city of Mount Vernon, from placing $42 million in the water department. This is his assertion or allegation that funding will go to the water department and it would bypass office of the sorry, give me a second, of the Mount Vernon controller. So this is a story. So Derrickson Lawrence is a candidate to the Mount Vernon controller, Mount Vernon controller, and he's a plaintiff in a lawsuit that was filed this past week. And he wants to prevent the transfer of emergency federal American Rescue Plan, ARP, funds by the Mount Vernon City Council that would circumvent the office of the controller for which he's running and thereby be or could be illegally directed to the Board of Water Supply. Evidently, Judge Susan Case of the Westchester Supreme Court signed his order to show cause. So we're going to wait to see what comes out of it. And Derrickson Lawrence said that we live in a democracy based on the consent of the governed, Derrickson said. And he says that I bring this case or this action on behalf of the tired and frustrated taxpayers of Mount Vernon to bring order to the disorder and to promote responsible receipt and transparent use of ARP funds in the way that will meet, one, the short and long-term financial needs of the city of Mount Vernon, conform to the federal guidance on the use of the ARP funds, and the terms of the Mount Vernon City Charter and the New York State law. So the legislation as it's written as of April 28 of 2021 violates local and state laws and does not serve the public interest. As such, it cannot and will not stand, asserted Derrickson K. Lawrence, who's running for city council, a city comptroller. So we have to await the city of Mount Vernon in order to be able to find out what their response is to Judge Kakase, and then we'll know exactly where it's going to. So this is going to be very, very crucial. We've got a couple of more minutes before I tell you about something else. Bear with me a moment here as we move on to there. I'm looking for that article. All this is on the Yonkers Tribune website. We also have the Mount Vernon Tribune website, Ossining Tribune website, Greenberg Tribune website, Yorktown Tribune website, the Yonkers Tribune website, Bronxville Tribune website. I think that covers all seven of those municipalities that we spend greater time and emphasis than we do in other parts of Westchester or Rockland and even further up. Bear with me one second here. One moment. Okay. All right. We've got about 7 minutes. So let me tell you about this. It turns out Westchester County District Attorney Miriam E. Rocha and County Executive George Latimer announced that the county is funding a local police for interpreter services. Well, the Westchester County District Attorney Miriam E. Rocha and Westchester County Executive George Latimer announced over, I think it was on the 19th, no, I guess we posted on the 19th a few days ago, that the county will provide funding for local Westchester County police departments to access real-time interpreter services through LanguageLine. And the move will allow law enforcement agencies to better serve residents, witnesses, and crime victims in their native languages. There was a comment at the end of this article which pointed out that supposedly Yonkers Police Department have this capacity, and this capacity allows a unit carried by hand, and it will allow someone of English speaker or a Spanish speaker to speak to a person that spoke any one of 240 languages via a mobile, video, or phone system, and the team of this operation called Language Line incorporates more than 14,000 professional interpreters. I first learned of this program called Language Line at Columbia Presbyterian, which unfortunately I had to attend because of ill health. And now over a month, I think it's about a month and a half ago. And then at that time I was in a room getting medical attention, and the person that I shared the room with spoke Spanish, and the doctors, many of them, most of them, I was fascinated by the fact that most of them did speak Spanish. Some you could tell were actually originally from South America or Central America or the Caribbean or from America itself, and they spoke Spanish no matter what their ethnic background, other than just their language. But then there were some that didn't speak Spanish, and yet they had this ball, small ball, a little bit bigger than a baseball. I don't know how much bigger you would call it to be, but maybe the circumference was about 5 inches, and they would be able to carry it in their hand. They would express their issue in one language. They would interpret to a second language. So I guess there must have been a way to say, I want an interpreter of English to Spanish, or I want an interpreter from English to Creole, or I want an interpreter from English to Russian, or however. So with 240 languages, that's absolutely amazing. There was a comment. Let me just quickly go to the bottom of this. And this is what it says. Yonkers has been using Language Line for at least 20 years, as are many of the other Westchester County agencies. So they berated in their comment that it was just a headline-seeking splash by the Westchester County District Attorney. Well, if it was, certainly the funding was not there necessarily, but I guess it would have been much more salient and more, or rather not salient wouldn't be the correct word, it would have been much more palatable to this individual that commented in order for them to be made aware, because they were already aware and they didn't, and this telling from the county executive as well as the county district attorney did not mention that there were some communities within Westchester County that did not need to get funding from the county in order to pay for this service. However, it wasn't explained, for example, that Yonkers had this service. That means Yonkers must be paying for this service out of its own pocket through the police department budget. And the question now becomes, will the county reimburse or take over the cost of funding this particular service and resort to funding the cost to the city of Yonkers, which will be very interesting, and I'll try to follow that up with the county executive's office to find out if that will be the case. I could also actually find out directly from Yonkers City Hall. They should be able to respond to that. Okay, so looks we've covered quite a bit. It's just about 45 minutes before, 45 seconds rather, before I hope to speak to the one and only Sean Patterson Howard with respect to the lawsuit filed by Derrickson Lawrence and with regard to conduct by the Mount Vernon City Council, which would sidestep the city of Mount Vernon's capacity to hold on to the funding through the office of the comptroller in Mount Vernon, rather than to permit, as it's been permitted so far, to bypass the comptroller by the Mount Vernon City Council. Extremely valid form of governmental, questioning governmental conduct and purview over their rights. So that's the question, which evidently was a salient perspective with Judge Kakase, because when she heard the argument from Derrickson Lawrence, I'm losing my mind at times, I'm on very heavy medication. So when Derrickson Lawrence presented his case to a Judge Kakase, she evidently agreed there was validity to his question, and she demanded a statement, and in order to rectify if this was appropriate under the Federal American Rescue funding plan, and that whether the Mount Vernon City Council would be able to circumvent the office of the comptroller for which he's running, and thereby could illegally direct the Board of Water Supply of funding to the Board of Water Supply to the tune of $42 million. Wow, heavy duty stuff. And so we're still looking at something with regard to the Board of Water Supply. There was a time, if you remember way back, when the Mount Vernon's Inspector General, Larry Procari, advised at that time the mayor of the city of Mount Vernon, Richard Thomas, that he could utilize monies that were held by the Board of Water Supply, which is not a department of the city of Mount Vernon, but rather a New York State department. But in reviewing the law, Mr. Procari, the Corporation Council, informed the mayor, Mayor Thomas, that it was appropriate. And at that time, Procari was put into incarcerated for misinterpreting incorrectly, it seems to turn out now, you know, incorrectly incarcerated. But it's now after the fact. He's still incarcerated. I do not think he's been released from jail. And yet it's proven by other law or assertions that have come out from government that it is appropriate to have taken the funding. So there's no real oversight body that has made an assertion on this one way or the other. However, we do find that the comptroller, Deborah Reynolds, who had oversight of monies when Thomas was mayor, and she is no longer running for re-election, and so she's not going to need to contend with this concern. Derrickson Lawrence is a candidate for that office, and I guess he wants to protect his position should he become elected to the city, Mount Vernon City Comptroller. So he wants to make sure to retain his power as it's defined by law, and that would serve him well. So this is a major, major concern. I see it's already 11:34, and so that's all I can do with respect to that particular story. So bear with me a moment as we try to get into other issues as well. Bear with me a moment here. Okay. So we spoke to that issue. And all right, let's just see where we go from here. All right. Oh my God, I can't believe it. We have a ton of people on the website. With our latest article, which reveals that the City Council wants the Inspector General in Yonkers, Leah McLaughlin, to look into the conduct of Yonkers City Council President conduct to vis-a-vis the his relationship with his employer at the firm of Smith, Buss & Jacobs. And so they will know that he complies with all state city law. And so that's the request of Inspector General Leah McLaughlin in the city of Yonkers. Okay, let me go back here. It looks like she hasn't come on the line. So bear with me a moment. And we'll go back to our studio screen and speak to you about some other issues that are reflective here. Okay, one second. One moment here. Where are we going here? This is an interesting article written by Earl H. Tilford. Tilford is a military historian and a fellow for Middle East and Terrorism with the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College. So he writes, the current fighting in Gaza rapidly approaches total war intensity. Strategy for Hamas has always involved the total war objective of annihilating Israel. For Israel, fighting Hamas and Hezbollah, which is based in Lebanon and Syria, involves a long, protracted, but limited war of attrition. Now, this may be changing. Hamas and Hezbollah use terrorism and guerrilla warfare as a form of attrition to wear down Israel while simultaneously exploiting world opinion by depicting Israeli retaliation as heavy-handed. This cannot continue in perpetuity because fighting a limited war against an enemy with total war objectives favors a side willing to go all the way. So the total war objective of a Jewish free Palestine favors Hamas. Well, the Hamas handbook clearly states its objective, no Jews from Haifa to Ashkelon, from Jerusalem to Joppa, to many Jews. It's reminiscent of Reinhard Heydrich's outlining the final solution at Wannsee in January 1942. The lessons of the Holocaust are burned into the soul of Israel. A final solution is not amenable to a political lesson. To a political resolution. Israel is a sovereign nation established by the United Nations 73 years ago. While many Palestinians are willing to accept that, Hamas has no intention of reaching a political compromise with a Jewish state. There can be no compromise for a Hamas determined to liberate Israel. Hamas uses terror as a tool. It started with suicide bombers infiltrating Israel to blast cafes and buses. Self-detonation led to the closing of border checkpoints. Israel responded with an anti-infiltration barrier, a wall that worked. Then came rocket attacks. At first, homemade missiles with little effect before Iran started furnishing rockets able to reach Jerusalem and Tel Aviv with greater destructive power. Within a week, Hamas fired over 3,000 missiles into Israel, with an estimated 9,000 rockets remaining to be fired. In the past, after running out of rockets and conducting a few suicidal raids from tunnels, dug into Israel. Hamas called for a ceasefire while mobilizing media to depict Israeli retaliation as indiscriminate and overly harsh. For Hamas, this is standard operating procedure. For Israel, it is lunging at the Toreador's cape, a futile effort inevitably ending in death. Advantage Hamas. Well, this three-generation-old war has become a struggle of enmity and hatred with survival at stake. If, as is possible, Hezbollah opens a second front supported by Iranian Revolutionary Guards, this will become Israel's war of survival. While costly for Israel, this kind of war goes to an operational level where Israeli advantages in technology and firepower work well, advantage Israel. Israel's relatively limited manpower is its greatest liability. It cannot win a perpetual war of attrition. Nevertheless, history teaches that aerial bombardment can harden the will of subject populations. Indiscriminate rocket attacks will coalesce Israelis and harden their resolve for whatever casualties may come. Additionally, rocket attacks will coalesce Israelis and harden their resolve for whatever casualties may come. Additionally, universal military training also works to Israel's advantage because most able-bodied Israelis, including women, serve in the armed forces. Israel is a nation of well-armed citizens. In a war of survival, the advantage goes to Israel. But upon combat, urban combat is horrendously bloody. Israeli bombing and artillery strikes have created rubble-strewn streets useful for channeling invading forces into ambush kill zones where armor is more easily neutralized. Furthermore, urban combat is multidimensional. Hamas will command the rooftop high ground to attack from above while also forcing Israeli infantry into house-to-house fighting at the street level. In downtown Gaza, Hamas can move forces across rooftops. At the subsurface level, Hamas will attack the Israelis from tunnels and sewers. That is why Israelis are attacking tunnel systems. Israel must also win the media battle. Israel's enemies, and they are legion, are already saddling the Jewish state with indiscriminate attacks on civilians. While this is exactly what Hamas is doing, it is also adept at flipping the propaganda tables. If possible, Israel must put an electronic prophylactic over Gaza. If not, bombing a building housing the Associated Press office offers a less elegant alternative. Well, Israel cannot afford worldwide images of dying children and mothers, along with caskets of heroes being carried through the streets of Gaza. Controlling the narrative is fundamental. That's the end of the story, written by Dr. Earl Tilford, who is a military historian and fellow for the Middle East and Terrorism with the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College in Pennsylvania. He currently lives in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, a retired Air Force intelligence officer. Dr. Phil Dilford earned his PhD in American and European military history at George Washington University. From 1993 to 2001, he served as director of research at the U.S. Army Strategic Studies Institute. In 2001, he left government service for a professorship at Grove City College, where he taught courses in military history, national security, and international and domestic terrorism and counterterrorism. So that's the story about him. Move over to studio screen. It's about 15 minutes to the hour. It seems that the mayor is not going to be able to solve the problem. That's why I was prepared. Bear with me a moment here. I want to go into some other concerns. We'll cover them in a moment. All right. Okay, let me just check one other thing here. All right, one second. Where are we going to see this? I'm looking to see what else I'm looking for. All right, where are we? Okay, just got noticed that Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, said that he will continue to undermine Hamas at this point and not give them a break unless they stop at their end. So that's where both parties are at opposite ends. So we'll see where that goes and how long that will take. How much political pressure may be had by both sides with respect to the story. We'll find out where that goes. Okay, bear with me a moment here. Drop the phone. We're here, so we're okay. And now I want to go look at one last thing here. One second. Okay. All right, let me see if I can get this info for you. One second. All right, 1 minute here. Where are we here? This, I think, you'll find very interesting. At least I do. I'm a religious guy myself. It turns out the Chateau de Versailles is preparing extensively for its grand reopening. The Chateau de Versailles has been a hive of activity as everyone prepares for the grand opening on Wednesday, that's today, with the easing of COVID-19 restrictions in France, dusting, hanging of works, restoration of marble. The extensive team at the Chateau de Versailles have been hard at work preparing to welcome back the public from today onward. The Palace of Louis XIV is open to receive 800 visitors every half hour. Tourists need to reserve in advance. And these restrictions will continue until at least June 9. Catherine Bigard, the president of the Chateau, expressed her great emotion, quote unquote, at the idea of reviving, quote unquote, this place and, quote, rediscovering the world for which it was built. It is absolutely breathtaking. Go to France 24, France24.com. And you will definitely see it there. It's absolutely a breathtaking sculpture. The Royal Chapel of the Chateau de Versailles, revealed after major renovations from April 6 to 2021, that it's ready to go. So unbelievable. So from April 6 to May 19th, about 5 weeks? The photo is breathtaking, so go to France 24 if it interests you. Just absolutely brilliant. One second. This is interesting. The Spanish Prime Minister has visited Ceuta. It's a city on the Moroccan coast that's owned by Spain. Over 8,000 migrants have entered from Morocco through to Ceuta. So too long, it may just be too long to hear, but listen to this report. I think it'll be okay. Bear with me a moment. Okay.
Between Madrid and Rabat, that's continued to mount. Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez on Tuesday after a record number of migrants entered the small Spanish enclave. Around 8,000 people arrived in Ceuta in just 48 hours, unimpeded by Moroccan guards, either by swimming or making the trip in small boats and rafts. Seen here, the Spanish army surrounding people stand the water and locking them back into the sea with batons, a journey worth the risk for these migrants.
I'm doing this for my son's future, not for me. There is nothing in Morocco, she says. Young people in this country are disgusted. There's no work, no doctors, no hospitals. I saw women leaving their children at home, others with their babies. They tried to swim across. It was chaotic.
The Spanish Interior Ministry said that half of the arrivals have already been sent back to Morocco.
Wow.
Earlier on Tuesday, Madrid summoned the Moroccan ambassador.
I've reminded her that border control has been and must continue to be the co-responsibility of Spain and Morocco.
African enclave Melilla, Ceuta has the EU's only land border with Africa,
right,
making it a magnet for migrants seeking to enter Europe from beaches a few kilometers south in Morocco. A spokesman for the government's delegation in Ceuta said the number of arrivals could still rise.
Okay. All right, so that's the story there. Bear with me a moment. Okay, I'm going to go back. All right, let me just check to see what else is there. This is interesting with regard to the former president, Donald Trump. Evidently, the inquiry into the former President Trump is now criminal, says a New York attorney general. That's totally fascinating. This, too, is a report from Franz Rancat. It reads that the New York State Attorney General's office said yesterday it was told that the Trump Organization, it has told the Trump Organization that its investigation of the company run by former President Donald Trump is now a criminal probe, not purely a civil probe. So Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance, a Democrat, has been investigating Trump's pre-presidency business dealings for more than 2 years. We have informed the Trump administration that our investigation into the organization is no longer purely civil in manner, a spokesman by the name of Fabian Levy said in a statement. We are now actively investigating the Trump organization in a criminal capacity along with Manhattan District Attorney, he said. Well, the Trump Organization could not immediately be reached for comment. Vance's office has said in court filings it was investigating possibility of extensive, and protracted criminal conduct at the former president's Trump Organization, including tax and insurance fraud and falsification of business records. Vance's probe began after Trump's former lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, paid huge hush money to silence two women before the 2016 election and claimed sexual encounters with Trump. That probe has accelerated since Republican Trump lost his bid for a second term in office, where Joe Biden became the Democratic nominee and became president, succeeding Trump. Well, the New York State Attorney General Letitia James, also a Democrat, is leading a separate criminal probe into whether Trump's capacity falsely reported property values to secure loans and obtain economic and tax benefits. So very compelling inquiry into President Trump's business dealings, which is very, very important. Okay, one second. All right. Okay, bear with me a moment. I want to just check to see what else there is on the international front. Actually, not very much at the moment. Bear with me. We've only got less than 5 minutes, so I wanted to just tell you what we've got scheduled for tomorrow. Bear with me a moment here. Tomorrow's Thursday. Okay, bear with me a second here. All right. Sorry for the delays. I don't know. Well, tomorrow for sure, we're going to have John and Lori Wiles. I don't know the car that they're going to be reviewing tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. But they will join us at 10 o'clock in the morning for a half hour's time. And we'll see where they take us and what their review will be. 10:30, I expect that we'll have some other people that will attend our show. I don't have them written down right now, and contemplating them won't work. But even the car review by John and Lori Wiles, it's known to them, but I don't remember what it was. No way to look at it at the moment. So I think we're all set here. Let me quickly go back to our studio screen. I think we're fine somewhere here. Yes, we are. We'll say goodbye, and we thank you for being with us today. All the best, and hopefully you'll join us here tomorrow. Take care and be well. Goodbye. Okay.